Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Imagine this, spending 23 hours a day in a small, windowless cell with virtually no human contact, no external stimuli, and no sunlight. That's the reality for more than 80,000 U.S. prisoners currently being held in solitary confinement. While most other democratic nations have discontinued the practice, long-term solitary confinement is increasingly routine in American prisons. A series of new studies show that the psychological effects of such deprivation counters any goals of rehabilitation. Joseph Strongberg is a reporter and science blogger at Smithsonian Magazine who wrote about the science of solitary confinement for SmithsonianMag.org. Joseph, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me on, Virginia.
Now, that number sounds very high, between 80 and 81,000 male and female inmates in solitary at any given time. Is that number on the rise?
You're right in saying that it's a huge amount, and it is on the rise. I think for researchers, one of the frustrating things is that there's no central piece of data that the U.S. government collects on solitary, because sometimes it's federal prisoners, sometimes it's state-level prisoners. But the best censuses do indicate that it's somewhere around 80 or 81,000. And it's a number that is increasing because prison administrators use solitary confinement for a few different reasons nowadays.
Well, why? Why would people end up in solitary?
The basic context is that our prison population is overall rising. But administrators use it for a few different reasons, use solitary for a few different reasons, I should say. There's the most basic one of disciplining prisoners, which is probably what most of us think of when we think about solitary. It's also used as a tool coercing prisoners into cooperating with different rules. Maybe cooperating with an ongoing police investigation or preventing them from talking to others during an investigation. It's even sometimes used at prisoners' own request if they feel there's a threat within the prison population to their safety as a preventative measure. And so based on the fact that the prison population itself is increasing and all these different uses for it, it's exploded over the past couple decades in the U.S.
So paint a picture for us of what solitary confinement is like, you know, the size of the cell, sun exposure, human exposure.
Yeah, it's probably hard for a lot of listeners to imagine living this way. The average cell is maybe 80 square feet on average. So that's like the size of a queen size bed. You won't have any exposure to sunlight. You might not have a window. So it's not the bars that most of us picture when we think of a prison cell, but rather just a steel door. And you're going to be in there at least 23 hours a day. You might have an exercise period either out in a prison yard or in an enclosed inside area. You won't have human contact. You won't have stimuli. A lot of solitary prisoners, even when they do receive visits from friends or family, they are prevented from touching them. And so I think one of the most really disturbing things to think about is that they might go years, if they're in solitary for years, they might go years without touching another person except for when guards are putting them in restraints.
So given that you're not touching anyone, you have no contact with others, what are some of the psychological effects of being in solitary confinement?
Yeah, the psychological effects are difficult to study because many prisons are resistant to letting researchers or academics inside. But Craig Haney, a psychologist at UC Santa Cruz, who have been able to gain access and conduct interviews with some prisoners, he's conducted interviews with 500 prisoners in solitary from four different states. And he's found that these prisoners have significantly higher rates of symptoms like dizziness, heart palpitations, chronic depression, hallucinations, suicidal thoughts, than the general prison population. And a study that actually came out last week found that isolated inmates in the New York State prison system are seven times more likely to hurt or kill themselves than the general inmate population.
So one of the things that really struck me is you cited some evidence that there are neurological implications of long-term isolation. What might those be?
Yeah. So like the psychology, the neuroscientific implications are even more difficult to study because there are no prisons that are allowing researchers to come in with MRI imagers or other types of technology and look at the brains of prisoners. So they really have to look at other types of models and their basic understandings about the principles of the brain. But those have, for one, there's the fact that so much of our brain activity is driven by circadian rhythms. So that's our body's natural clock that's set by the rising and the falling of the sun every day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's easy to imagine that if you never saw the sun, your circadian rhythms would be interfered with. Other research has found that when people who have chronic depression for extended periods of time, the activity in their brains is less well aligned with their circadian rhythms. And there's been other work that shows people who are restricted access to the sun are more prone to depression. And so it's easy to imagine that if you don't see the sun any day for years in a row, you're much more likely to develop depression. And there's also other work that shows the hippocampus, which is an important brain structure involved in things like memory, cognition, decision-making. This can dramatically shrink over time in people who are depressed for extended periods. And so this might account for some of the evidence we have that people who spend long periods of time in isolation are perform worse on decision-making skills, their memory is not as sharp, and they, in general, appear to be less well-equipped to re-enter U.S. society at large.
Joseph Stromberg is reporter and science blogger at Smithsonian Magazine. He's been studying and looking over some of the studies on the science of solitary confinement. What happens when an inmate is held in solitary, psychologically, physiologically? And Joseph, you just got to something I was going to ask you about. Inmates can become increasingly violent. Their decision-making faculties are changed.
Mm-hmm.
What do those things mean in terms of rehabilitation, the goal of imprisoning them in the first place?
Yeah, I think the implications of this are disturbing. I think one interesting thing I'd like to mention is that this isn't all exactly news. The beginning of institutional solitary confinement was in the mid-1800s in the U.S. as part of something called the Pennsylvania model of imprisonment, and this was reformers who thought that to rehabilitate prisoners, they had to isolate them and allow them to get in touch with their own thoughts and connect with God. And even back then, administrators, prison governors realized that this was essentially driving many inmates insane and doing the opposite. And so that's exactly what we're seeing today as well.
Mm-hmm.
All evidence is that prisoners who have spent extended periods of time in solitary confinement are less well-equipped to enter society at large. And if that's one of the goals that we have for the prison system, solitary's failing at it.
And we hear a little bit of this firsthand from Robert King. He was on a panel at the American Association for the Advancement of Science's annual meeting in Chicago. He was confined in solitary in a Louisiana prison until his murder conviction was overturned in 2001. What did he talk about for the experience?
Robert King is now an activist and an author who's fighting against the culture of solitary confinement in the U.S. prison system. And he spoke about how he thinks he fared a lot better than many people who stayed in solitary. You know, he was always hopeful that his conviction would be rightly overturned. But at the same time, he spoke about really disturbing physical changes. His eyesight began failing him when he spent time in solitary, and he realized that he'd have to perform different types of eye exercises just because he was never asked to focus on anything further than about 6 feet away.
And how long was he confined?
He was confined for 29 years.
29 years?
Yeah, from 1972 through 2001. And yes, and like we said, the murder conviction was overturned. And so apart from his failing eyesight, he spoke about how since he's been reintroduced to the world at large, he has difficulty navigating large spaces. Navigation is actually a capacity that's tied to the hippocampus, that brain structure we spoke about that can shrink when people are depressed for long periods of time. And so he says he's no longer able to, you know, navigate a walk of 10 city blocks. That part of his brain simply wasn't called upon to navigate the world at large for such a long time that it's made that difficult for him.
So he's one activist, Robert King.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's a lot of, you know, attempted legislation and activism in the criminal justice system in general, but I'm
mm-hmm.
wondering if there is a legal case that can be made based on the Eighth Amendment prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment against solitary confinement.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility that a lot of researchers are looking into now, researchers and activists both. I think as the evidence builds about how solitary affects the brain and affects people's psychology, I think that might be an avenue that is pursued in the future.
Well, last Wednesday, New York State government reached a settlement banning the
mm-hmm.
use of extreme isolation
mm-hmm.
for juveniles and limiting it somewhat for adults. So do you think, Joseph, the tide may be turning?
I think that's hard to say. I think that it's important for us to at least begin analyzing how solitary affects people, because I think one of the remarkable things is that prison systems have been doing this without really looking at scientifically at the consequences of it for a very long time. And I think as researchers and psychologists and neuroscientists gather more information about it, it might prompt the tide to start turning. I think the New York State decision is a big one. I think that's one of the larger state prison systems, and up until now had one of the largest amounts of prisoners in solitary confinement. So it's a start.
Joseph Strongberg, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Joseph Strongberg is a reporter and science blogger at Smithsonian Magazine. You'll find a link to read his article for yourself. It's called The Science of Solitary Confinement. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. Even those who are free to roam the world and the internet can lose their perspective when swayed by impossibly beautiful imagery. We'll take a closer look at some of the viral images, so well-crafted, people think they're the real thing.
One thing that might be obviously fake to one person could be completely plausible to another. So it really shows you that people want so desperately for something to be incredible.
That's when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Well, it's happened to everybody at one point or another. You open up your Facebook feed and see an outrageous photo someone posted, maybe of John Lennon playing guitar alongside Che Guevara, or maybe a photo of the Buddha carved in an impossible-to-get-to rock formation, and you think, that cannot be real. But it looks so real. As photo editing software becomes more sophisticated, telling real from fake photos on the internet is becoming more of a challenge. Matt Novak writes the Paleo Future blog over at Gizmodo.com, which is where we found his post, Inside the Fakes Factory, by chat with a viral image creator. And Matt, welcome back to Word of Mouth. And I want to make a note here that Matt was on our very first episode of Word of Mouth 8 years ago, pretty much this week. Matt, great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Virginia. It's hard to believe it's been that long.
I know. And we still keep going. Well, let's start with this Buddha carved in the rock formation. People may have seen this photograph. It is just spectacular. It looks like something out of a movie set. Who is the artist behind it?
Well, it's actually an anonymous artist. I was put in contact with a man who wanted to remain anonymous, who's part of an online art collective known as Reality Cues. And they have a project called Graffiti Lab, where they manipulate different images that they find online. And it turns out a lot of these images wind up being passed along as real.
So does he go like full Banksy manipulated voice, or did he speak with you straight on?
We actually just chatted over GChat. So that was how I talked to that person. But I've talked to a number of other people through various means who want to keep themselves away from the public eye for one reason or another.
Now, we joke about the idea of pressing a viral button to make something on the internet spread exponentially. But this guy and others who work in this Graffiti Lab project has kind of cracked the code for making images go viral. What's the method?
Well, obviously this person from Reality Cues uses Photoshop, and it was actually an interesting point in our discussion when I asked him, how, if there were other images other than this incredibly popular one of the Buddha carved into this tall rock formation in China. Just impossibly tall. It would have been incredibly hard to make, and it obviously was not made. It was a Photoshop creation. But I asked him, are there other images that are obviously fake that get passed around? And he, clearly was amused by this, because it's so hard sometimes to see what is obviously fake. One thing that might be obviously fake to one person could be completely plausible to another. It's interesting to see how people want so desperately for something to be incredible in the world, and for that to be some sort of validation that people can really do incredible things.
Well, it's not only that people want them to be real. Some people say they visited these sites.
That's true. He sent me along a Tumblr post that a young woman had made where she claimed that she had actually seen this Buddha carved up in this impossibly tall rock formation.
Well, maybe in a Shaolin warrior movie or something like
sure,
that.
Sure.
But you describe these photographs as clearly photoshopped. But a lot of people do believe these manipulated photos are real. Why do you think that is? I mean, to you, they look absolutely fake. To others, they see a place and think, oh, there are so many places in the world I haven't been. This could be real.
It's interesting because not everything that I look at in this sort of what's become a recurring series for me, looking at different fake images online, not everything is obviously fake. Sometimes something just doesn't smell right. And I'll use some of the fabulous tools that are now available online to what's called reverse image search them, which is to put, rather than, most people are familiar with Google, where you type in some kind of search query that's via text. There are actually tools now where you can plug in an image and look at other places where that image has appeared. And oftentimes you'll find the original source for it. Other times it takes other methods, but that's obviously a good first place to look. Sometimes it's the description itself that's off. It's not necessarily that someone had manipulated an image. For instance, today I just had a post that went up that showed Audrey Hepburn supposedly dancing, and it turns out it was a very recent stock image of a dancer, but from it looked so much like her that I had to find a different image of it, a higher res image of it, in order to be able to zoom in and show that it clearly wasn't her.
Are they playing with that idea that our image of reality is so often photoshopped? Or all of these fake images kind of creating skepticism in a public that will never believe what they see?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. I think that, a lot of people see this as sort of a new phenomenon that started with Photoshop, and that it's turning us all into terrible skeptics. And I'm not sure that that's entirely true. We have to remember that long before the invention of Photoshop, people were making fake images. For instance, there was an image of Teddy Roosevelt riding a moose made in 1912, and it's a pre-Photoshop manipulated image that still gets passed around today, funnily enough. So it's tough because a lot of these issues are not new. I can't speak to what the actual motivations of this online art collective are, but they definitely want to highlight some of these issues about how we define what is real when it comes to landscape or architecture.
Well, I'm interested in how you feel about it as the editor of Paleo Future. I mean, you look through all sorts of old imagery and writing about how people predicted the future. So in a way, there becomes this kind of aspirational quality, to a photograph of us or a picture of us, an image of people on a moving sidewalk or in a jetpack or something.
Right.
So can it provide some kind of dreamy sense of where we're going?
For sure. I think you really hit it on the head there with aspirational being the key word. As you said, I study all of these past visions of the future, whether it's jetpacks or flying cars or meal pills. And I often come across these sorts of ideas. That's actually what got me interested in this fake viral images to begin with. It was this image that was getting passed around of people supposedly on an airplane in the 1960s. And the caption that was getting passed around is that this is what coach class used to look like. And it was incredibly luxurious. It was, people had plenty of leg room, and it was lots of headroom, and it would just look very civilized, for lack of a better word. The catch was that it was actually a mock-up that Boeing had done. It wasn't a real plane. It was an aspirational image for Boeing. It was a plane that had never actually existed in the real world outside of a photo studio. This was the first sort of kicking off for me this interest in these broader ideas about sort of what we want to believe about the future and what we want to believe about history. I think we often romanticize the past, especially when it comes to air travel, while forgetting any number of different issues or even forgetting that, some of these images could be fake.
Well, we can dream, Matt.
We can, yes.
Matt Novak writes the Paleo Future blog over at Gizmodo.com, which is where we found his post, Inside the Fakes Factory, my chat with a viral image creator. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Virginia.
If you'd like to see some of those too-good-to-be-true viral images that are popping up around the internet, we've compiled some of our favorites, from a spider with a 6-foot leg span to a frozen-over Niagara Falls. The pics can all be found on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And we're going to continue with tales of fooling the eye and the mind. Up next, a 19th century hoax that remains one of the greatest cons in American history. Step right up for the giant Indian of Cardiff. That's when Word of Mouth continues, after the news from NHPR. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There is money to be made in playing on people's faith and curiosity. Witness this slice of history from the Memory Palace podcast. Nate DeMayo looked into what may be the greatest hoax in American history. A pair of men who capitalized on the belief that giants once roamed the earth.
Henry Nichols wakes up early one Saturday and rides out to Stubb Newell's farm. Stubb is his brother-in-law, and sometimes he throws him some cash to do some odd jobs, like paint a fence or whatever. This time it's to dig a well. Henry brings his buddy Gideon with him. Gideon had lost his arm a few years back in the Civil War, but he says he'd be willing to give Henry a hand, so to speak. And Stubb takes them out to the field behind his barn, points to some spot in the ground. It seems totally arbitrary. And Henry and Gideon start digging. And the whole thing is taking forever. The ground is really hard, and they're digging for hours. Then Henry's shovel hits something. Gideon clambers down into the hole. He starts clearing away the dirt with his one hand. And he finds a foot. A giant foot. George Hull was getting nowhere. He had spent years farming tobacco in upstate New York, trying to find riches in the soil. He had done pretty well during the war. People wanted their cigars and they couldn't get them from the Carolinas anymore. Then the South surrendered, and everything went south, up north. His business fell apart. So George Hull decided to look for actual riches in the dirt. He headed to the gold fields of California. And on his way west, Hull stops in Ackley, Iowa. And he's at a bar, and he gets into an argument with a Methodist preacher. George Hull is an atheist, and a loud one. And the preacher is a drinker, and a loud one, and the two go at it about the Bible all night long. The preacher is all literal word of God on one side, and Hull's all book of fairy stories on the other. And the crux of their particular version of this predictable argument hinges upon a line in Genesis that says, "There were giants upon the earth in those days." And that is just too much for George Hull. He can't stand how dumb people are. They'll just believe anything. Henry and Gideon believed they had found a dead Indian. That's what they said when Stubb Newell came back to check on how well the well was doing. "I declare," one of them said, "some old Indian has been buried here." And it was some old Indian. The body that lay there in the dirt was 10 feet tall. It was hard as a rock, heavy as hell. A nude male figure lying prone, twisted slightly at the hips, sort of smiling. Henry and Gideon started freaking out. For years, they had heard the people of the Onondaga tribe tell stories of stone giants that lived in the forest. Maybe this was one of them. And maybe it would wake up. But Stubb Newell had a different theory. One that had been handed to him by George Hull. One night, 2 years earlier, Hull had ridden into Cardiff, New York, looking for someone who had a farm, a shovel, and a good poker face. Because he had a giant he was looking to unload. He found his man in Stubb Newell. Hull had told him about the preacher in Iowa, and how annoyed he had made him, and how he wanted to stick it to that guy, and stick it to everyone, really, who believed in nonsense and hokum. So he came up with a plan for a grand hoax. He would make a petrified man. It can take millions of years to petrify something. It took George Hull, too. He spent a few months getting money together by selling off shares of the inevitable windfall that a petrified man would bring. It took a while longer to find a giant block of marble and a sculptor to carve it into a giant, and then time to make this freshly carved statue look like ancient flesh, sanding it down and chipping out chunks of ankle and shoulder and thigh, and dipping it in acid until it looked the way he imagined a giant man would have if he had fallen into a bog back in the time before Abraham, and then had become petrified. And then he dug a hole in the dead of night. A year later, Stubb Newell was standing by a hole in the ground with a lump in his throat. A day after orchestrating the incredible discovery of a biblical giant in his backyard, he was already making money off of it. He'd put a rope around the pit and charged his neighbors $1 for a closer look. But the big payoff, the riches he'd been fantasizing about since George Hull knocked on his door the spring before, depended on the four men in the hole. People needed to believe it. It was one thing for some farmers and field hands to awe-shuck some word of mouth around his little hamlet. His neighbors would believe anything. For the giant to really draw a crowd, he needed people with some actual authority to buy in. He needed scientists. And here were four doctors from neighboring towns, trained physicians, crawling through the dirt, poking and measuring, and conferring in authoritative tones. And when the four men climbed up from the hole, muddy and wide-eyed, and declared that the giant was the genuine article, Stubb Newell breathed easier, and he put up a tent. The world descended upon Cardiff, New York. Headlines called the statue the Cardiff Giant and called it the biggest scientific discovery of the century. Tourists rode in on horseback and omnibus. Within weeks, whole hotels were built to house the gawking throng. Stubb Newell was making money giant hand over giant fist and squirreling it away for George Hull and his secret cabal of investors. And then they took the giant on the road, and at every stop, the crowds grew. But so did the risk. Each town had its own experts, its professors, its lecturers of note, who'd all take a crack at the giant. But most bought it. The giant, Genesis, the whole thing. Some didn't, and they said it was a statue, but an ancient statue from some lost civilization, which would have been a giant discovery, if not a petrified one. But every now and then, someone would call it what it was, just a giant scam. But George Hull and his investors managed to stay a step ahead, moving on to another city before people caught on and demanded answers, and they would have to own up to reality. There was one person who didn't care at all whether it was real. P.T. Barnum knew a good show when he saw one, and he made them an offer. He would pay them $60,000 to rent the giant for 3 months. And this was a good deal. That's about $1 million of today's dollars. And George Hull had only spent the equivalent of $30,000 to make his petrified marvel. Their tour was still doing well, but not that well. They'd never make that kind of money in 3 months. They didn't have Barnum's promotional genius. And most importantly, they didn't have his mammoth museum in downtown Manhattan. But they didn't take the offer. Because Manhattan was the problem. They had managed to make a small fortune off an outrageous fake. But people were starting to poke holes in the story, letting little drops of doubt seep in. 3 months in the spotlight, in the biggest city in the world, the whole thing was bound to get washed away. So they said no. And Barnum said fine. And then he made his own giant. No one could figure out exactly how he did it. Maybe someone made a plaster cast in the dead of night. Maybe someone had been surreptitiously making elaborate sketches at every stop on the tour. But in the fall of 1869, an exact replica of the Cardiff Giant went on display in Barnum's museum. And of course he claimed it was the real thing. The owners of the real fake giant were outraged. They threatened to sue. And Barnum said, bring it on. You bring your giant into court, and I'll bring mine, and we'll ask a judge to decide which one is really a petrified person. George Hull knew he was beat. He signed a book deal, and then he admitted the whole thing. And people still came to see the giant for a while. It may not have been a real magical, mythical creature, but it was still pretty cool. It wasn't a real giant, but it was a giant celebrity. And George Hull took his money, and he sold some books. In reading the book, George Hull seems like kind of a dick. And this from a person who loves a good hoax. I can totally get behind a charismatic con man. But George Hull began this whole thing with the premise that people are idiots. And looking back on it, he seems pretty smug. Like he was sure that he pulled the rug out from under the faithful fools who bought into this biblical stuff and this magic and mystical nonsense. But the truth is, he didn't have a rug. He had a tablecloth. You yank it out and the silverware is still in place. You haven't spilled a drop. If belief could survive Copernicus and Galileo, it could survive the Cardiff Giant. And you didn't have to be a fool to be fooled in 1869. You were a farmer. You were a dock worker or a candlestick maker or a scrivener. Where had you ever been? What had you ever seen? How good were your textbooks? How learned were your learned men? And this fake giant had real power. One day you're tilling your field or you're working your terrible job, living your hard life. Someone over yonder digs up a giant in their backyard. It had enough power to change people's days, to draw a crowd, and to make some people rich. It gave a one-handed farmhand a story to dine out on for the rest of his life back in the 1870s. It gave him a Wikipedia entry today. It sounds enough like magic to me. I'd pay a dollar to see that.
And our thanks to the Memory Palace podcast for that story. Up next, some contemporary flim-flammery and abject corruption. A newly discovered report on ethical lapses from active duty military and military contractors so flagrant it borders on the comic. We'll get a report on the report when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. The title, The Encyclopedia of Ethical Failures, may sound like one of those novelty books of humorous historical anecdotes, but it's actually a 164-page government document detailing hundreds of instances of bribery, graft, and other infractions within the Department of Defense. And despite the bureaucratic subject matter, the report is written in a breezy, informal style not commonly found in government reports, something that got the attention of Gordon Lubolt, senior writer at Foreign Policy Magazine. Gordon, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this sounds like the kind of information that the DOD generally works to keep under wraps. So who put out this report, and what was the aim?
This is compiled by the Pentagon's General Counsel's Office, but most of these reports are generated from the Defense Department's Inspector General's office. And that, of course, is the office responsible for investigating criminal activity and all kinds of other bad behavior across the department.
Your article makes note of the language and tone of the Encyclopedia of Ethical Failure. So give us some examples of how it might be different from other government reports.
Right, right. So it's big on this kind of breezy language, as you say, really to kind of make it readable and fun. And what they're really trying to do is to tell people this is not what you should try at home. They compared one. There was a naval officer. He was married and with children, but he had an affair with a woman, and then left that area. I think he was in Texas somewhere, and moved to Connecticut. But sent an email to his former mistress saying that he was dead. You know, it was like sent as if somebody else had sent it. She tried to go pay her respects to the dead man, only to learn that he'd actually just moved back to Connecticut. But the writing in the entry in the encyclopedia refers to this as akin to a daytime soap opera, that it was another example of this kind of silly wrongdoing, but something you should not be doing.
So one officer fakes his death to get out of trouble in an affair. Another, a federal employee, promised a college substantial grant in exchange for an honorary doctorate. What were some of the ethical breaches detailed in the report that maybe most surprised or captured your interest?
Right. So there's a lot of just kind of basic fraud. you know, whether it's contracting officers who work in the military, and some of them, by the way, a lot of these examples are outside of the Defense Department, but for the most part, they are.
Yeah, I noticed that an abundance of people stationed in Iraq, Afghanistan, supporting bases in Kuwait, lining their pockets by arranging and awarding government contracts.
Exactly. So, you know, in one case, there was a fence that had to be built, and a contracting officer got a $5,000 payment by giving the $153,000 job to a particular contract. There was another one in Iraq, I think, where it was a water bottle contract, and it was a similar thing. So there's a lot of these kind of fraudulent ones. But then there's like kind of the funny ones, like this guy who, you know, worked in a maintenance shop and, you know, took the shed at the maintenance shop to his house and installed parts that belonged to the government on his own personal truck. Just kind of these ridiculous things. Then there's like the kind of darker examples of just wrongdoing and, you know, taking a lot of money from the government. Part of why this is a big deal now, and this particular encyclopedia that I think has been published now for a couple years and updated each summer, is there's a kind of, as the wars end in Iraq and Afghanistan, there's more wrongdoing being kind of emerging, kind of revealing itself across the military. And some of these actually are very serious, and in some cases they involve sexual assault. In some cases they just involve, you know, senior officers taking planes where they shouldn't, that kind of thing. The scope and the scale of it is not yet clear, mm-hmm. but the Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel, the Pentagon chief, is very interested in trying to find out how deep this goes and then how to fix it.
Yeah, there's some big money here. A contracting officer at a camp in Kuwait awarded contracts and blanket purchase agreements, calls to those contractors $5.8 million as a payment for his actions. You mentioned senior officers. Any high-ranking officials implicated in this?
Right. So some of these are unnamed and some of them are kind of generic, but they're all true stories, and then some of them are named. I mean, there was the kind of the – it sounds slightly – silly example, but nonetheless true example of four senior officers who, you know, basically should have known better. They extended their trip in Tokyo to play golf at a conference that really where no business was being done, and it was like a $3,000 basically charge to the government. But on the other hand, like, they should know better, and they're supposed to be not only upstanding citizens, but, you know, leaders in the military.
This sounds like the kind of stuff that goes on in the private sector all the time, but different rules obviously apply.
Right. So, you know, the military is clearly a reflection of society, although some in the military would say it should be, you know, better than the society it protects. But, you know, that's the kind of the issue is that are these a few bad apples? You know, and the military is obviously very large, too. So all these examples is just a fraction of what's really out there. But, you know, does it almost disproportionately paint the military as, you know, a bunch of ne'er-do-wells? And I don't think that's fair. I think that, you know, there are bad apples in the military, but just like there are in society. But some of these that are really large, it's amazing that people could get away with it for as long as they did. I think the Defense Department would tell you that, you know, the lesson learned here is that these people were all busted.
Yeah, after the fact, we find out. What kind of oversight is on the ground, do you think?
Well, there's obviously all these investigative arms of the military who are looking for things. I think it's probably there's more and more scrutiny on ethics now in the military, but that's kind of an emerging trend here, as I say, like with the end of the wars. And so I think it will police itself a little bit, maybe even better. Part of the idea is that the wars were going on for so long that there wasn't a lot of time to pay attention to these kinds of things. As maybe as ridiculous as that may sound, but now the garrison military, most of the force is back at a regular base in the United States or somewhere else and not fighting wars, and there's a little more time to pay attention to this stuff.
Gordon Leubold, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Gordon Leubold is senior writer at Foreign Policy Magazine. He also writes the Situation Report newsletter, which comes out every day. You can get it yourself. More information at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you can also read his article about the Encyclopedia of Ethical Failures. You can read the document itself, all 164 pages. A link at wordofmouthradio.org. With the Olympics in Sochi now behind us, we remember that winter sports roll on even after the spectacle. With the Paralympics and among viewers inspired by shows of grace and athleticism at the Winter Games. NHPR's Sean Hurley recently visited the Jackson Biathlon Range. It is the only course in New Hampshire dedicated to the sport that was created as a form of alternative military training in Norway. Here's Sean with more.
I ski hard across the dipping snowfields to get my heart pounding, drop to my belly in the target box, and wrap myself around an Ishmash, a 22 caliber Russian biathlon rifle. 50 meters away, the golf ball-sized target jitters in my front sight. I exhale, hold steady, pull the trigger. Shoot off 5 rounds and ski away. Wayne Peterson, owner of the Jackson Biathlon Range, looks through his scope to see how I've done. He shakes his head, either with amazement that a novice shooter with only an hour of training and really thick glasses can shoot so well, or because I am the worst shot he's ever seen. A hay and cattle farmer most of the year, Peterson turns the family's rolling patchwork of fields into a ski and shoot course beside the looming Twin Crown of Doublehead Mountain.
Nordic skiing in the States is a fringe sport to begin with, and this is a fringe sport of a fringe sport.
The fringe of the fringe here, but
in Europe, biathlon is the largest winter televised sport.
World Cup events can draw upwards of 80,000 fans. And while Norway, France, and Belarus have been the big biathlon winners at Sochi, the U.S. has never won an Olympic biathlon medal. As with the curious sport of curling that seems to mix shuffleboard with housekeeping, the biathlon crosses the woodsy pastime of skiing with target shooting.
It's kind of like mixing together two things that don't seem like they would go.
Well, that's the dichotomy of it. I mean, high-level skate skiing or Nordic skiing is, you know, you're right at this, your aerobic threshold, right? And then you ski up to the range, and you have to really change your mentality. You have to switch. Okay, I was a skier, but now I'm a shooter.
Therein lies the lure of the sport, the artful transition from peak action to peak stillness.
And so the race, you start off and you go out and you ski a lap. It's anywhere from maybe a half kilometer to probably 1.5 or 1.75 kilometers in length. And you come back into the range and then you transition to being a shooter.
You take 5 shots at 5 targets.
And if you miss 2, then you go and ski 2 penalty laps. And they're around 200 meters long, right? So you want to be long enough so that it makes a difference to your skiing time.
Though it hasn't been officially posted, Peterson, who coaches a junior team, believes North Conway's Sean Doherty will likely be a candidate for the U.S. team's biathlon relay.
You know, the way we kind of look at it is, you know, this range may produce the next Sean Doherty. And we have a junior team that's training here. He's come up here a couple of times, and he's skied around with the kids that are on my junior team, and they're all just, you know, I mean, he's an idol to them.
We arrived downrange to look at my target sheet and my 5-shot group.
You are not the worst novice first-time shooter I have ever seen.
Right.
So right now, you have not a terribly bad group, right?
There are many ways that Peterson could let me know that I am, in fact, the worst first-time novice shooter he's ever seen. But the sound of him adjusting the rifle's sight is clear enough.
You wouldn't normally make that big of an adjustment for somebody that was shooting, but...
But seldom does a shooter come along so poor of eye, so nervous of hand. I shoot again with the adjusted sight.
Oh, don't look at the scope.
Peterson looks through the scope.
It's going to be terrible.
Shakes his head, kneels down beside me to adjust the sights again.
All right.
I ski away into the field and, without any good reason, simply crash into the flat, well-groomed trail. And there, in the snow, in my own way, discover the artful transition from peak action to peak stillness that all biathletes must master. For NHPR, I'm Sean Hurley.
Thank you for spending some time with us today. We invite you to join Word of Mouth's mission to spread new ideas. You can post links to segments on your Facebook page. You can retweet things you heard to your followers or email segments to your friends. Just click on the Facebook, Twitter, or email icons at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again tomorrow at 2 and again at 9 to hear more of what's bubbling up on Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio.